The U.S. and Cuban government on the verge of a new battle, this one over baseball. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Major League Baseball has a new deal with Cuba to hire baseball players. This in order to avoid the smuggling or defection of the players. But it also means a portion of their salary goes to the Cuban government. What's the line between protecting players and supporting a communist regime? And we'll tell you about a special art exhibit now open in Fort Lauderdale that highlights art from the Seminole community. Finally, menstruation is a conversation that can be difficult for parents to have with their daughters or even between women.
Women can have their period from 2,500 days to 3,500 days of their life. That amounts to 10 years.
The new podcast, The Flowdown, from a Miami Beach native, discusses the stigma and major questions that we have about periods. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, one of the biggest exports coming out of Cuba is baseball talent. But up till now, getting those players out of Cuba and into the major leagues, well, it's a harrowing journey for those players because they either had to be smuggled into the U.S. or they had to go through other countries. And because of this process, smugglers can and have gotten involved. And there's a new deal now between Major League Baseball and the Cuban government that might end that problem. But it also means that Cuban players now have to share a pretty big chunk of their money with the Cuban government. Senator Marco Rubio wants the Trump administration to end the deal. As an editorial note, we did reach out to Senator Rubio's office to have him join us for this conversation and, of course, express his criticisms over the agreement. And we're still waiting for that response. We're joined now in studio by WLRN's Latin American correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And Paul Minoff is an attorney from Gray Robinson Attorneys at Law, and he's representing a Cuban baseball player, Leonis Martin, in a lawsuit. We're going to find out more about this this lawsuit. But Paul, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time, man.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And by the way, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about this agreement and about the ongoing relations between the U.S. and Cuba? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Is this a good plan? Is it a deal to protect the players? Or, you know what, do we not want to give money to the Cuban government? Again, 800-743-9576. Tim, let me start with you. Let's start with this deal with Cuba. Baseball is a national pastime there as well.
Right.
They have a professional league, though, right? But
sure.
Really, everything is, for any player in the world, it's about coming to America.
Oh, sure. They have a very good league. In fact, they're having their playoffs right now. Now that the winter has started, like many Caribbean countries, Dominican Republic, Venezuela, et cetera, baseball developed there when Americans brought it, you know, in the sugar industry, the oil industry back in the 20th century, and the locals became much better players, really, than many of the Americans. And so that's why baseball has such a strong tradition in the Caribbean, and particularly in Cuba.
And right now, I mean, checking, there are about 29 active Cuban players playing in the major leagues. I mean, mm-hmm. That's not including the minor league system, but 29 right now. Right. This is a deal that goes back to the Obama era. What's
right.
The deal?
Well, when the Obama administration normalized relations with Cuba, it determined that the Cuban Baseball Federation was not technically an arm or a branch or a part of the communist Cuban regime, let's say. And so therefore, despite the fact that we've had this 60-year-long economic embargo against Cuba, Major League Baseball could then strike a deal with the Cuban Baseball Federation to allow these Cuban baseball players to sign directly with major league teams, so they wouldn't have to go through this, as you just called it, this harrowing, odyssey all the time to get into the league.
Does that also mean Major League Baseball can be in Cuba because you have to look at the players?
Well, that's one of the things that was an obstacle, obviously, and Paul could address this, you know, the legalities of this very well, but that was always an obstacle because of the embargo. It was one of the big reasons that these players always had had to go to a third country before they could come to the United States, because Major League Baseball, technically, because of these arcane embargo rules, could not negotiate directly with players in Cuba. They would have to wait for them to set up residency like in Mexico or the Dominican Republic, and that's where the problem started, because all these unscrupulous smugglers and agents would pounce on these guys, and there were some, as you said, pretty harrowing stories.
And Paul, so you're currently representing this player, a Cuban player, Leonis Martin. I say that right? I'm sorry.
Yes, correct.
Leonis Martin,
center fielder for the Cleveland Indians.
And he's challenging this group that I guess has been representing him, a group called Estrellas de Baseball. But what is this case about exactly?
Well, just so it's clear, that case is now over. It's been over for quite some time. The case started what would look like any normal lawsuit. An industry or a company suing an individual claiming that services were provided and that compensation wasn't fully paid. What really was at the heart of it, and what we argued in the lawsuit, and ultimately which led to federal prosecutions here in Miami in the Southern District of Florida, was that this organization really wasn't anything but a front for a very sophisticated smuggling organization that involved Cuba, United States, and specifically Miami, and Mexico, and scouts and trainers and a whole bunch of other individuals who all worked together in a coordinated effort to bring Cuban players like Leonis Martin here to the United States.
And remind people how they did it. I mean, again, they would pick up these players in these other countries and basically say, well, we're going to get a portion of what you make, but we're going to help you get into the United States.
Yeah, I don't know that it was so specifically spoken that way. It was a matter of a Cuban baseball player wanting to get to the United States. I mean, this is the Mecca for baseball. As great as the Cuban national teams may be, they're not the Major League Baseball. So Cuban players know that if they really want to play in the big league, so to speak, that you play with the Major League Baseball. So there were individuals out there who would scout and look for players, and some of them wanted to leave. Some of them were maybe persuaded or enticed to leave. And there was this sort of, it was like an underground railroad almost. You would find a boat somewhere off the coast of Havana in the middle of the night. You'd get on the boat. You would hide out for a little while until clearance was given at some port. At the time when Leonis came out, it was in Mexico, and they would land disembark in Cancun, and that's where the process started.
And did Major League Baseball, what did Major League Baseball say about the fact that, you know, how these guys were getting in, or did they even care?
I mean, it's hard to speak on behalf of Major League Baseball, and I'm sure if you ask them, they'll have an answer that might make it like they didn't know. I don't know what they actually knew. I mean, obviously, these players were getting here. These players were establishing residency somewhere else. I mean, my opinion on it is that it was sort of turned a blind eye. It didn't matter. As long as these individuals were getting into the United States legally with clearance to the extent that was required from the federal government, as long as they passed their health inspections or their health exams, that it wasn't a Major League Baseball problem. And I think, again, I can't speak for Major League Baseball, but I think their position is it's not our concern how they got here. It's whether they were legally here. And if they were legally here, then they could play.
And so this is what the deal is, Tim. It's basically to circumvent that issue and make sure that it's legal.
Last month, Major League Baseball and the Cuban Baseball Federation, as a result of this Obama administration ruling that we were just saying, designates the Cuban Baseball Federation as not an arm of the Cuban government, the deal they struck last month was that players in Cuba, as long as they've had 6 years of experience with the Cuban Baseball League, they can now start negotiating directly with major league teams from the island without having to, defect at all. And the catch, and this is what people like Senator Rubio object to so much, is that as a result, the Cuban Baseball Federation can collect about 15% to 20% of whatever multi-million-dollar contract that Cuban baseball player inks with a major league team. Now, technically, that you had mentioned in your introduction that would be a big chunk of the player's salary. Technically, the agreement says no. This is a fee that major league baseball teams will pay on top of the salary that player gets, but that's a technicality.
Yeah, and then you're talking about 20% up to 20%, and that one of the top players, one of the top Cuban players, within the last couple of years, Was Yonis Cepedis. He was with the New York Mets, and he had a $22.5 million contract. So I guess there's that fee that, you know, very big portion of that fee goes to the Cuban
government. And the irony is the Cuban baseball players are some of the better paid people on the island. They make about, they can make as much as about $500 a month compared to $30 a month for, say, your average, you know, bureaucrat in Cuba.
Again, talking about this new deal between Major League Baseball and the Cuban government, and it's basically so that Major League Baseball can have access to that very rich pool of baseball talent and not have to have players smuggled into the country, because as we've reported over the years, you know, some of these players have to go through other countries, or again, they're being smuggled in by different groups to get them into the United States so they can have that chance, or they have to defect so they can have that chance perhaps to play in Major League Baseball. If you have questions about this deal, but really I'm asking you your thoughts, you know, should we have a deal where we're protecting players even though we're going to be paying, in part, there's going to be money going to the Cuban government, maybe not have that deal? What do you think? Give us a call. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Again, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, and you can post your comments there at WLRN Sundial. And, you know, Paul, as you had mentioned, I mean, there have been people who have gone to prison for this. There was a baseball trainer charged with, you know, previously indicted agent with prosecutors because he had been smuggling in players through Cuba as well. And he had a couple of his partners as well. That, and this was within the last year, actually, this story broke. But how many players are we talking about? How many players do you think had the same issue that your client had?
It depends on how you define the issue. If the issue is being smuggled out of Cuba, there are dozens of players who have come out of Cuba. If the issue is how many made it to the United States, ended up with some lucrative contracts, and now are fighting back against their smugglers who are, you know, taking significant portions of their salary directly as opposed to some fee on top of what they would otherwise get, couple handful. I mean, this is very underground. This is very unknown. Without naming any specific names, there was one baseball player who came through the same channel that my client came through, and he ended up with a very lucrative contract and ended up paying 30% of his contract directly to the smugglers. The way that these deals work is that, and to put this in perspective, what, you know, Senator Rubio is focused on is that we may be giving some large amount of money to the Cuban government. I don't have any insight on whether the Cuban Baseball Federation is or is not a communist bloc or arm of the government, or whether it's going to funnel ultimately the money to the government. Yes, some amount of money is going to go into Cuba. The question is that better or worse than some significant amount of money going to some smuggling organization? Because it's not like there's not money already being paid. It's just a matter of where it's going. When Leonis Martin made the decision to leave Cuba to ultimately end up in the United States, through a chain of a 7-month time frame from when he left to when he arrived in the United States, he signed an agreement to pay this organization 35% of his salary, 30% going to supposedly the training organization, and 5% to his agent, the same agent you were just talking about, Bart Hernandez, who was just sentenced last year and actually filed his appeal last week. But that was 35% directly off the top pre-tax dollars that he was being assessed, and a lot of other players were. And there were players who were afraid. They didn't know what they were dealing with. These individuals, in order to be able to run this type of organization, and at the time out of Mexico, you're talking about a lot of people turning their heads. You're talking about the Mexican police, the federales, you're talking about the Zetas. All of this came out in testimony about how many people were getting paid to look the other way for two reasons. One, to open up the borders, and two, to protect these players. And actually a third reason is to help them get the documentation that they needed so that they could ultimately negotiate with the United States government.
And one of the other things, too, I remember reading is that, you know, the smugglers, they kept a grip on the players because they would always threaten them, say, Yeah, but your family's still back in Cuba.
Oh, yeah.
We can get to them.
This rose to really criminal levels in many cases. I think one of the most notorious is the case of Yasiel Puig, who became a right fielder for the Los Angeles Dodgers. I think he's now with the Cincinnati Reds. But his story was like something out of a Narcos script, you know, on Netflix or something. You know, it involved people being shot. It involved, you know, people being threatened on boats that if, you know, enough money didn't come through for the smuggler, they'd all be tossed off, off the boat and, you know, to the sharks in the Caribbean. I mean, this was awful stuff. And I think that was one of the, this is what made this deal between MLB and the Cuban Baseball Federation so urgent, because there were so many stories like that bubbling up and you know, getting out in the media.
And if then there are a lot of players, by the way, just real quickly, there are a lot of players. I mean, we hear about the Puigs and of course, your client and a few others, but there are a lot of players. They get stuck somewhere in the middle. They never make it. They never get to the U.S., so they never get that chance. So what happens to them? Do they end up just going back to Cuba? I mean, when you leave, I mean, that becomes problematic for you, but what happens to them?
A lot of them, and I think Paul would agree, a lot of them languish in places like the Dominican Republic. They just end up playing for the leagues there and making not much more money than they would in Cuba.
Well, if they're lucky, they actually get to play for the leagues. In some instances, the players, they do get just abandoned or dropped. There have been instances, I've heard stories directly from, not the players themselves, but from people that are close to the players, which is worse than even being abandoned in Dominican Republic, is being abandoned in Haiti, because the channel is Haiti into the Dominican Republic, because Haiti is such a poor, corrupt nation that it's a lot easier to get your residency established in Haiti, and then you can cross the border legally into the DR. Yeah. But once the prospect of you, the player, making a lot of money is gone, either because the scouts aren't interested or because you get injured or something else happens while you're either in the Dominican Republic or in Haiti, then you're done. You have no longer any value. So these people get left. They can't just go back to Cuba, because now they've defected and they've abandoned the Cuban baseball team. And by Cuban law, you can't go back for 7 years after you defect. So that's not even an option. You're stuck in a foreign country. And even though you know, at least in DR, you speak the language, but you may not even have ID. Your handlers, or what they're called, your keepers, a lot of times they keep your passport, your driver's license. So you may actually be stuck in a foreign land with no money, no identification, no home country, because you can't go back to your country, and very little prospect of getting to the United States.
So you're hearing that, and I'm just wondering again your thoughts on this idea that, you know, should we allow Major League Baseball to have this deal with the Cuban government so that we protect players from having to end up in these situations? Or again, do you have a problem with the fact that, again, some of that money, there's going to be money going to somebody in Cuba and possibly to the Cuban government? 800-743-9576. Let me know your thoughts. Senator Marco Rubio, obviously against this deal, but again, the money was supposed to go to the Baseball Federation of Cuba, but that's run by a Castro.
Well,
how do we know if it's not going to get to the government or the military?
Senator Rubio's point is, don't be naive, okay? Any entity in Cuba is a part of the communist regime. That's just the way communist regimes are. I think what offends people like Senator Rubio most isn't the fact that there's, you know, money going from the United States to, you know, filtered to the Cuban regime. Because, for example, every time a U.S. tourist sits down and eats at a private restaurant in Havana, for example, part of that money is going via taxes to the Cuban government as well. What offends Senator Rubio, I think, is the volume of it, the level of money that we're talking about. You're going from, you know, just, you know, paltry taxes that private entrepreneurs are paying to the Cuban government in Cuba, as opposed to millions of dollars now going as a result of this fee from Major League Baseball, a U.S. entity, to the Cuban government.
Again, you're talking about almost 30 players right now active in Major League Baseball, combined salaries over $100 million, and they're getting a big percentage of that. So, Paul, basically, I'm getting that, you know, for you, this deal is a good thing because it protects players.
To that extent, yes. I don't want to see money going to the Cuban government. I'd love to see money going to the Cuban people, because we all know, you know, how they live, how they're treated. The reality is, the Cuban players are coming here. And the sadder reality is that Cuban players are leaving Cuba and getting stuck in foreign nations without the ability to go home. So if this deal allows Cubans to come here to get signed, have this opportunity, and then maybe they make it great, and they got here safely, they got here through legal channels, they got here without risking kidnapping, killing, maiming, torture, dangerous waters, then that's a good thing. And then if they make it here and they don't make it, so to speak, the you know, the contract, it was a one-year deal, they just don't have any prospect and they want to go home to their family, great. We can't ignore, I don't have a problem in theory with what Senator Rubio is concerned about in terms of money going to the Cuban government. My concern is, then what's the alternative? What's the option? We can't just keep status quo, because status quo means tens or hundreds of Cubans being pulled out of their home countries, being treated as a commodity, and potentially being put in dangerous situations.
And I could tell it was a difficult question for you to answer, because that's the tricky part. It's like, well, yeah, we don't want to see individuals have to go through these horrors, but at the same time, well, the Cuban government is going to benefit either way. Let me go to the phones real quickly. I want to bring in Aid from Miami. Aid, you have a comment on this issue.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say that the Cuban government controls everything. I'm a Cuban. I was born in Cuba. I lived there for 15 years. And the government controls sports, everything that has to do with education, and everything, basically. So that's what I wanted to say.
And how do you feel about this idea, this deal between Major League Baseball and the Cuban government? Do you think that we should protect the players, or just never, ever, you know, have set up a deal with the Cuban government where they're going to get money?
I mean, I think that if we make a deal with the Cuban government, we're basically going against the Cuban interest, the Cuban people. So at the end of the day, I think it's all about the people of Cuba. And if we give money to the government, that money will be used against the freedom of the Cuban people.
Thank you so much for the comment. I appreciate it. Paul, you wanted to say something about that.
I was actually going to ask Aid if it was better, if it's worse to give money to the Cuban government than to allow these trafficking operations to exist. These trafficking operations exist. There have been news outlets that have gone to the Dominican Republic. They have elaborate fields and trainers and handlers. I mean, this is a huge network and huge operation. This is a multi-million dollar operation. There are a lot of people making a lot of money off of these players that, and a lot of times they're taking advantage of them. The typical baseball contract provides for a 5% agency fee. That is the baseball standard. It can be up to 5%, but 5% is pretty standard. So you're a baseball player, you hire an agent, he gets you a contract with the Miami Marlins, and he's going to get 5, or she is going to get 5% of your salary. You know, maybe you got to pay the trainer a little bit of money, you got to pay the gym, whatever. You get involved in one of these operations of smuggling, and you're paying between.
So there are thousands of words that refer to getting your period, like it's that time of the month, I'm on my rag, it's Mother Nature's week, and many others. And as more women participate in the fight for gender equality and the Me Too movement, WLRN web editor Jessica Weiss and her friend, who's a women's health coach, Stephanie Kleinbird, decided it was time to break the silence around the topic of periods.
Last October, Jessica and Stephanie launched their podcast called The Flowdown.
It's a podcast all about periods, and they talk about topics from menstruation cycles, the shame and the stigma surrounding periods, and self-care.
Jessica joined us in November to talk about the importance of normalizing the conversations that society has around this issue, and they've released 8 of their 10 episodes so far this season.
Women can have their period from anywhere between 2,500 days to 3,500 days of their life. That amounts to 10 years when you add those days up to the life of a woman. So that's a lot of time that women are spending on their periods, bleeding. So why is it that this incredibly natural, common experience, an experience that's actually really biologically incredible that creates life, why is it that we're not talking about this? My co-host works with women. She's a women's health coach, and I know her through actually my own experience working with her as a client. And through working with her, learned so much about my own period, about my own body, about the amazingness of this human process, and decided that this is so natural. This is so normal. Why can we not talk about this?
And before the podcast, though, do you feel like you were comfortable talking about it in your own personal life? Or were you also treating it like it was kind of that topic, don't touch it?
Yeah, it's not that easy for me to talk about either. It's getting easier the more that I am talking about it, the more that the podcast is out and people are actually starting to approach me to talk about it and these conversations are happening. It's really, really exciting. I'm getting more and more comfortable. But no, this wasn't something that I was, you know, really, really, that it was really easy for me to talk about before the podcast.
Something fascinating, too, is listening to this is the two of you share your own personal stories.
Yes.
And this is part of the connection that the two of you have with each other. And I wondered, you know, in that process of having the dialogue, how it helped you in dealing with your own, with mental health issues, but also with the physical issues that you have to go through.
Yeah. So one of the repercussions of not having conversations around periods is that people that bleed don't know if their symptoms are quote unquote normal. So what sometimes happens is that, you know, when you can create a conversation, someone might begin to say, wait, so that extreme pain that I'm having every month that's causing me to, you know, double over in pain, to miss work, you might start to think, once you start to talk about it, wait, maybe that's not all that normal. I've always been told that having a period is an experience of suffering. So I just assume that that's normal. And so by not talking about that, we're sort of continuing to allow people to stay in the dark about their own experiences. So the more that we talk, the more that we realize that, wow, my experience of, you know, sadness or depression or anxiety or severe pain or extremely heavy bleeding, you know, that's a shared experience. And also that's something that maybe I can help by talking about it and also by finding things to sort of aid in that personal experience.
From the stories that you heard from different women and the research that the two of you did for the podcast, what is your conclusion as to why there's this stigma on this topic?
I think a lot of times women are taught that they have to sort of, you know, keep it together. They have to look a certain way. They have to smell a certain way. They have to be out, in order to be out in the world, they have to present in a certain way. And what a period does is makes that a little bit harder for women. And so it's something that I think we have learned to deal with privately, to cover that up so that we can exist in the world, so that we can have be respected.
Did your mother ever set you aside to talk to you about this issue? And I wonder, in the stories of other women you talk to, did a parent, did a guardian, did somebody in their life sit them down when they reached that age to explain to them?
So I interviewed a historian who studied the history of how we deal with menstruation, how we manage menstruation. And she explained that even just 100 years ago, getting a period meant just like a shock. No one was talking about it. There weren't educational pamphlets. There were no sex ed videos. There was nothing. So oftentimes what would happen is a girl would get her period and she would think she was dying. And then her grandma or mom or her aunt or somebody would give her a cloth and say, just deal with it, not tell her anything. There has been a steady movement to share more information, whether it's a mom or a guardian or some female figure or a teacher in schools, you know, the pamphlets that come with these products. There has been a movement to share more and to educate young girls more about their periods, but it's still across the map. There's still women. I talked to a woman recently who told me that when she got her period, she wrote her mom a note, slipped it under the door, said, Mom, I got my period. Her mom, it was like very transactional. Her mom gave her a pad and that was the last they ever talked about it.
Think about that. And, you know, with different groups, different ethnic groups, minority groups, we talk about education and accessibility. They're not touching on these issues and they have less access to feminine hygiene products. Florida has, by the way, is one of 11 states, I have to mention, without a tampon tax. Mm-hmm. That's the additional sales tax on menstrual products. But how does the accessibility feed into the conversation? What have you seen? What have you heard?
There's a statistic that a woman can spend over $18,000 in her lifetime on menstrual products. That's a lot of money. Think about if you are trying to live and, you know, survive and eat and cover your basic necessities, menstrual products, and especially, you know, nice or safe or a lot of menstrual products is not a priority for you. So you're going to do whatever you can to manage the blood in a way that's inexpensive. Sometimes that could even compromise your health and your hygiene. These are things that I don't think we think about. So there are a growing number of organizations that are trying to improve access to menstrual products for all people.
I'm talking with Jessica Weiss. She's the co-creator and co-host of a new podcast called The Flowdown. It's a podcast about periods. Jessica and her co-host Stephanie Kleinberg talk about topics from the menstruation cycles to shame and stigma surrounding periods and self-care. Jessica is talking to us about how she and Kleinberg are breaking the silence around the topic of periods. And to be clear, Jessica Weiss is a web editor for WLRN. In one of your episodes, you speak with Kiran Gandhi, the musician and a period activist. Some folks will know Kiran from her decision to run the London Marathon while menstruating and choosing not to use a tampon. And her story went viral all over social media, as you know, and you discussed on the show, and of course, even by the president. And you asked her about why she chose to do it.
I never was like, oh my God, I'm so scared to do this. It was just like, this is duh. This is like, jump right in. It's like if you're in front of like an ice bath, you can't hesitate. You just gotta like go for it. That's very important to me because I think we as women have excellent, excellent intuition, but we do live in the patriarchy and we do live in a masculine world that only values like data and science and calculation.
Tell us about Kiran and what you took away from that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, she's incredible. She's the former drummer from the band MIA. She's drummed with Thievery Corporation. She's an amazing solo musician. So beyond being a musician, she's a really strong voice for the feminist movement and for inclusivity in conversations around feminism. She's just amazing. Everyone should Google her and look at the picture of her finishing the London Marathon. She was on the starting line of the race she'd trained for months. She got her period and she said, you know what? I don't want to use a pad. I don't want to get chafing. I don't want to use a tampon. I don't actually even have a tampon right now and I don't know where to get one. So she was like, you know what? I'm just going to bleed. I'm just going to do what my body is telling me to do, and I'm just going to bleed. The point of her doing that, you know, was beyond just it being a personal experience and decision, she made a statement in doing that about how amazing it is to have a period and all of the things that we can, you know, still do when we're on our periods.
I'm wondering, too, if just the timing right now for the podcast, but that you have the Me Too movement, that we're seeing this shift in society and it's becoming more comfortable to talk about this? Or again, maybe it's still a topic I think that's tough to decide, but I'm just a guy. That's my perspective. But I don't know. Everything, do you sense we're finally comfortable a little bit more?
I do think that we're becoming more comfortable. We'll have a guest on an episode, a 20-year-old Harvard student who is doing incredible things to break stigma. And she created an organization called Period. When she was 16, she began to really learn about the need for conversations and products. And she represents, I think, Gen Z and this growing comfort with talking about really tough things. And she's leading the movement that's sort of now being dubbed the menstrual movement. And it encompasses people from all, you know, aspects of society, from the product side, from the activist side, from the legislative side, policymakers, all these people that are starting to have an awareness around the importance of having these conversations and talking about periods. And hearing her talk about this menstrual movement is pretty inspiring. And it does really suggest and convince me that we are reaching a new level with these conversations.
It's been a couple of months since the podcast release, and I'm wondering, what's been the response? What have you been hearing?
We've been pleasantly surprised by the feedback that we've received. I think people have been really enthusiastic about the content. We weren't sure. We were honestly quite nervous when we were going to release it. You know, do people want to talk about periods? Do people want to hear about periods? And I think that they do. I think people are hungry for these conversations. People feel validated in personal experiences that they've been having for so many years and not having anyone to talk about them with. And we want to encourage other people to join the conversation. I think people haven't been asked too many times in their life to think about their own period and to share things. And so that's what we want to do. We want to open people up to this idea that they can talk about it.
You know, I have to admit that at the beginning, I thought, well, this is probably a podcast really set more for women. So obviously, as a guy, I'm coming at this from a very different perspective. But at this stage of my life, I mean, I've lived with women. So, I mean, from that perspective, that's what I know. But listening to the podcast, I said, wait a second. After living this many years, I thought I knew something, and I'm realizing I don't know anything. this isn't just a podcast for women. This really is something, because it to break the stigma, I think, everybody really needs to take the moment to listen and then have that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Like, why can men not talk about periods? Half the population has a period or, you know, will at some point. So you know people that are having their period all the time. And I think that it's really important if we're going to advance conversations around gender equality and gender equity, if we're going to, you know, if you consider yourself a proponent of women, then I think it's important to get involved in this conversation and to realize that this is not something that should be stigmatized.
Tell us about what's coming next. And by the way, remind people too where they could find the podcast.
So the podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We're The Flow Down. You can find us on Instagram at flowdownpod, and our website is flowdownpod.com. We're going to wrap up season one with 10 episodes, and then we'll take a short break and come back for season two. And we're just going to continue to explore this issue from all angles. We have big ambitions for the podcast. Among them is to actually create more of a sense of a community around our listeners. And we want people to get involved. We want menstruators to share their experiences with us, to ask us questions about their own periods, to ask us that question that they've always wanted to know or have answered. So I'm myself, you know, continuing to be on a journey to learn about periods and to break the stigma.
And again, that was Jessica Weiss. She is the co-creator and co-host of a new podcast called The Flow Down. It's a podcast about periods. She and her co-host Stephanie Kleinberg talk about the topics around the issues of menstruation. Now, the shame and the stigma, I mean, that's just, you know, one of the challenges, and that's why they created this podcast. They've released 8 of their 10 episodes for the season. And again, just a note, Jessica Weiss is a web editor for WLRN. We'll have a link up on our Facebook and Twitter page at WLRN Sundial so you can check it out. Well, still to come, an art exhibit with a massive collection of art created by members of the Seminole Nation. That's coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A new exhibit at History Fort Lauderdale highlights a mix of work from South Florida's seminal artists. There are documentary films, paintings, and clay sculptures that pay homage to the Seminoles' rich history in South Florida and the environment essential to the tribal community. It's titled Seminole Art Scenes from the Front Lines, and it's on display through January 28th. I want to introduce you to two of the artists. Joining me here in studio, Erica Dietz, a contemporary painter whose work is also on display at the Low Art Museum and the University of Miami and at the Governor's Mansion in Tallahassee. Erica, great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Also joining me is Samuel Tommy. He's a filmmaker, painter, and an environmental activist. He's also going to do a little performance for us today. Samuel, thanks so much for being here, man.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much.
And you can see some of the work again on our social media. Just go to at WLRN Sundial on Facebook or Twitter. Help us understand real quickly how exhibits like this are so important to protecting, you know, the history and traditions. Erica, let me start with you. Explain how through your painting, you know, you connect to those roots in that tradition and make sure that it lives on beyond you.
I feel it gives the viewer a snapshot into our traditions, our culture, and not only them, but it also helps us to keep that alive within the generations that are here now and the next generation.
With your work specifically, what is it? What is the tradition, or what is it about the history of the Seminole Nation that you want to protect for future generations?
Oh. Let me do a little correction. It's Seminole Tribe of Florida.
Thank you.
And Seminole Nation's from Oklahoma.
Thank you.
And so as for my piece, it's called Clan Mother, and it's depicting Susie Jim, who has since passed on. And it has this 8 clans around her. And it's depicting how we pass on our clans through our the mother's side. And so that's a tradition that's carried on and that's part of us. And so not just creating it to show that, but to also teach the youth that that's how our traditions are handed down to us.
What kind of medium do you like to work with?
I like to work in watercolor, pencil, mixed media, which could be a combination of anything, and acrylic and pen and ink.
Now you've been painting and drawing for a long time, but then you stop for a while.
to raise a family. That happens. Being an artist, you have to have your inspiration, and sometimes your inspirations are your children, so you tend to put time into that.
Family's always a good excuse. That's yes. Okay. Samuel, you're a painter and a filmmaker. Tell us about some of your work, especially you have a film work that you've done that examines key environmental fights that are close to your heart in the Seminole community.
Yeah, there's a 5-minute short film at the History Fort Lauderdale Museum. That one's called In Our Creator's Hands. That one is a personal a journey that I did, just walking through the pristine areas of the reservation. And I took 2 weeks just to go out there and experience and just collect my thoughts and so forth. And I got to see the pristine area much closer than before at that time. And I also thought about what would happen to the environment and to the water and to the animals as I was thinking about the Florida Power, FPL, Florida Power Plant.
Because they want to build a power plant.
Yes, yeah.
In a particular area.
Yeah, so I was reflecting on those thoughts, and that's what that short film is about. Yeah, Florida Power and Light came to my reservation, Big Cypress Seminole Reservation, back in 2016, and we had a community meeting, which is at that time the Florida Power and Light officials talked about building one of the largest power plant in the country, and they would put it 4 miles north of my reservation, which is would be approximately 30 miles south of Lake Okeechobee. And they wanted to drill into the aquifer water, and things they would do would just drastically change the environment.
And, you know, real quickly, tell us a little bit about that area. Tell us about the land, because as you said, you took the time to go out there and really, I mean, kind of, you know, experience it.
Yes, it's a wonderful place. It was nice to just go out there and be on terms with the wildlife that's out there. What I mean by that is no knives or no guns or anything like that, and just be one with the animals. And the animals that we have out there are the small animals, raccoons, possums, fox, bobcats, and also we have Florida panthers and Florida black bears. And of course, we have the poisonous snakes out there as well. And the place that I went out to is where this place is very rich with this type of activities, animal activities.
And so your work in general is about trying to capture that serenity and that beauty and show it as it is before if it's ever lost.
It's true. I want to show what is out there and the beauty of it. And the thing is that I'm determined nothing's going to happen and nothing will happen.
See, that's an interesting part of the conversation, though, is, and this goes back to, again, protecting traditions and history and heritage. But it's also the fact that as we look at the history of Native American groups in the United States, is the fact that they had so much taken away. And so much is lost. You're confident that that land won't be lost to a power plant, but we see development, we see growth, we see cities constantly pushing up against these lands. Do you think that you'll be able to protect against that forever?
The land itself is very, very sacred for us. Everything on life, on everything on this planet is very sacred. It's part of creation. It's what the Creator hath done, and it has to be loved. You're either going to love all creations, or, you know, you're going to destroy that. And that's what I feel. And when I go out there and meditate out on a reservation, I like to go to one place where there's an ancient ceremonial ground. And I like to go there and meditate, take my time. Just on the west side of this ceremonial ground, there's a cypress tree, which is about 500 years old. And This is where I find ghost orchids. And this is a very interesting place. And so it is our history. It is Florida's history. And this is what has to be protected. Not only do we have to protect the environment that I'm talking about, it is our youth. It is our children's future, and they need to have it.
I want to get to this point as well. You participate in ceremonial rituals that practice known as land acknowledgement when any construction is coming around. And you do it, you play a flute, and you brought it with you. Just real briefly, because I want to hear just a little bit, but what is the ceremony that you perform?
Okay, it's called land acknowledgement, and this is where the conferences or conventions, national or international conventions, or a film premiere that I did. So this is when they call in an indigenous person of the region to come in and ceremoniously open their event.
And so you come in and you perform this. And again, I can only get a little piece of it because of time, but go ahead, and because you brought this beautiful flute with you. So... Absolutely beautiful. That is Samuel Tommy, by the way, and you're hearing him as he's performing this part of this ritual that they do, again, ceremonial ritual practice known as land acknowledgement when, again, construction begins on seminal ground. And again, talking with him, but also artist Erica Dietz about an exhibit that's going on right now at History Fort Lauderdale called Seminal Art Scenes from the Front Lines. It runs through January 28th. Erica, real quickly, some of the work that you're going to have on display, how much work do you have? What are some of the things that people can expect to see?
Just the pen and ink, which is of the Clan Mother, and it's stippling technique is done with that.
You know what? I want to ask you the same question that I asked him. Mm-hmm. This idea about, as time passes, unfortunately, a lot of things disappear. Traditions mm-hmm. will disappear. History will disappear. How does the Seminole Tribe of Florida, how does any group protect that history and try to keep traditions alive?
I think by teaching our youth, and growing up, my mother shared legends, stories with me. And so in going back with the art, it's we've become a more visual society. So I think with art, computers, technology, we can take it with us as far as language on, so that way the youth can learn their language and also sharing art.
And do you get the sense that the youth is embracing it? I think about, and I don't know if it's a fair comparison, but I think about like immigrant children. After mm-hmm. a generation or two, they tend to disconnect from their heritage and they, want to assimilate more to whatever the new society they live in. But are the youth embracing that and trying to protect it?
I'll have to say, I'm going to say yes, because I'm a positive person. I see things half full. So as for my children, they want to learn because I'm always with my mother and she talks to them in Ilabungi, which is the Seminole language. And so I think it depends on the family, and we as a family, which is a tribe, have to take that initiative to keep it going.
Well, I just wanted to mention that the studio is always open to you guys. I'd love to have more stories coming in from the Seminole tribe, because we'd like to help you in protecting that history.
Appreciate it.
Erica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Samuel, I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming in today, and especially with sharing the beautiful music.
Thank you so much for having us.
And again, that's Erica Dietz and Samuel Tommy. And again, their work is featured at the History Fort Lauderdale exhibit, Seminole Art Scenes from the Front Lines. It runs through January 28th. Please check it out. It's absolutely beautiful. Well, that's our program for today, this Monday, January 7th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.